Welcome to the Independent Advisors Podcast, where we dive into the world of stocks, tradable markets, and financial planning with Jessup Wealth Management's Chief Investment Officer, Mark McEvely, and CEO, Matt Jessup. You'll hear tips, tricks, and strategies to address your financial well-being, and most importantly, conveyed in a way that everyone can understand. Here are your hosts, Mark and Matt.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode 248 of the Independent Advisors Podcast, where Matt Jessup and I, Mark McEvely, bring you everything you need to know from the past week in the world of financial markets and financial planning. This week, Aaron Kramer is back on the show filling in for Matt. So welcome back, Aaron.
Appreciate it. Happy to be back on here.
Yeah, me too. We were just talking about how we should try to do this more, and just a few weeks later it worked out. So as always, we will quickly review the month-to-date and year-to-date performance of the major market indices that we track. This data is from Y-Charts and as of the market close on April 17th. S&P 500 is down 4.4% for the month of April and up 5.3% for the year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average down 5.2% for the month and up 0.2% for the year. The NASDAQ Composite Index down 4.2% for the month and up 4.5% for the year. The Russell 2000 Small Cap Index down 8.2% for the month and down 3.8% for the year. And the Vanguard All World X United States ETF down 4.1% for the month and up marginally 0.2% for the year. 3-month treasury rate sitting at 5.45%, the 2-year treasury rate at 4.93%, and the 10-year treasury rate at 4.59%. So moving on to big headlines, current events from the week, the market continues to be weak in the face of the first week of earnings season. Aaron, I know you have a couple data points on this here in a little bit, so I won't steal your thunder. And then obviously the other main thing that was in the media over the weekend was the Iranian attack on Israel, that was at least thwarted for now by Israel, its allies, including the United States, which is good because obviously from a humanitarian standpoint, but, as we talk about how this would relate to financial markets,
oil prices, I think the biggest
concern is oil prices, right? And with inflation starting to look like it's turning back up a little bit, that would just be, no kind pun intended, throwing fuel onto the fire with inflation. So, so that would not be a good thing. So, at least for now, that is in the rear view mirror.
But,
moving on to tweets, articles, and research from this week. The first thing I had, Aaron, was a tweet from Andrew Thrasher on April 10th. And Jenna will throw this up on the YouTube page and in our show notes. So he says, a good example from First Trust showing the historical results of letting political biases impact investment decisions.
This is a great chart.
This is awesome. It's one of my favorite charts of the year so far. And it shows the growth of $10,000 invested in the S&P 500 index since 1949. And specifically, the black line shows the S&P 500 if the money was fully invested in it and not touched. The red line is only investing the money during a Republican president, and the blue line only investing money during a Democratic president. And as you can see on this chart, Aaron, regardless of your political beliefs, if you're a Democrat, if you're a Republican, if you only invest in the market when your preferred political party is in office, it does significant damage to your long-term rate of return in terms of your portfolio. I mean, it's not even close, right?
No,
I mean,
no.
Both the, you know, investing only during a Democratic or Republican president, you know, $10,000 has only grown to less than $500,000, and you know, the S&P 500 since 1949, 10,000 turns into almost 3.5 million, right?
Absolutely.
So I think it's also interesting to point out here that, you know, I think, you know, Republicans are typically known for being a little more fiscally conservative, and there's a view out there that markets perform better out of under Republican presidents, but actually
not true.
Democratic presidents have had better years in the stock market.
Maybe it's due to spending, potentially.
And it could be due
stimulus.
To spending, right? But it's interesting because, you know, the Democratic Party is known for, you know, spending, not fiscally responsible.
Right.
And you would think that markets wouldn't do so great under that type of situation. But it's just an interesting environment and dynamic. And, you know, while it's fine to have your political beliefs, I know I have them. I know you have them. It's just best to keep it out of your investment
portfolio.
Absolutely.
I'm not going
to
invest based on them.
Correct. So, you know, obviously there's going to be a heated election coming up here in about 7 months. And just want to throw this tidbit out there to remember this chart.
Yeah,
when
put this chart in the back of your mind come November.
Yeah, exactly. And we might bring it back up again at that point in time. Second thing I had was a tweet from Scott Brown, who is a CMT or chartered market technician, and this was on April 8th. So he says, we're just 1 week in, but if historically strong April ends up negative, it could be a warning sign. So this chart on your screen right now shows the rest of the year return for the S&P 500 broken down by month whenever we have a negative month of April in any given year.
Okay.
So typically, you know, again, if we look at seasonality, Aaron, in any given year, April tends to be pretty strong, but especially in election years, it tends to be one of the strongest months out of the year. And we're not seeing that
the exact opposite.
Exactly. And it's kind of been an opposite year. Typically in election years, Q1 tends to be weak. Q2 and Q3 tend to be better, but it's kind of flip-flopped at least so far this year. Q1 was really strong. The start of Q2 has been really weak. So it's like, hey, what could we expect if the S&P 500 ends the month of April negative? Well, it shows that May and June are typically marginally down. July tends to be okay. August and September tend to suck. With the market rallying at the end of the year in October, November, and December in the fourth quarter.
Right.
So again, it's not hitting sounding the warning alarms just yet.
No.
But again, I just like to pay attention to this stuff because I like to know when markets aren't acting as they historically have. So it just helps us from, you know, a portfolio management standpoint make decisions, specifically buy and sell decisions. Because again, we use seasonality as a tool. We don't just blindly trust it because, again, if we only use seasonality to invest, we wouldn't have been invested in the first quarter and we would have missed, you know, a great quarter, right?
Sure.
So just something that I thought was interesting, you know, because April is pretty negative so far, at least the first 2 weeks of the month. Obviously, there's still time and earnings season can turn that around, but so far, April not acting as it usually does.
Yeah, this is interesting.
Yeah.
You know, usually it's, you know, September, October anyway before in an election year is pretty weak. I know we've talked about that in the past, but it's kind of interesting that adding April into that mix, see how it ends up.
Right, exactly. And, you know, we've been talking about this since the beginning of the year. You know, typically leading up to the election, we do see some volatility. So
absolutely.
You know, I would expect this year, August and September, to have some volatility. Does that mean people should go ahead and sell everything? No, I don't think so.
Right.
Because again, looking just after the election, regardless of the outcome, if we know who won the election, the market tends to rally in the fourth quarter.
Absolutely.
Really interesting work from
good chart. Good chart.
Scott Brown there. Last thing I had was a article from Emily Oster at Parent Data with commentary from Kitsis.com and their team. And this was titled, "There's No Secret Option C." So she says, life is filled with difficult choices, both in the personal and professional realms. Some of the hardest are those with two options, both of which seem bad. For instance, an individual with significant debt might have to choose between trying to pay the debt off, which limits their cash flow for other expenses, or declaring bankruptcy, which will negatively impact their credit score for years to come, potentially restricting their future financial options. When faced with a tough decision with two distinct options, there is sometimes the temptation to avoid making a decision in the hopes that a third, clearly superior option might emerge that will make the choice easier. However, this secret option C rarely comes about, and the time spent avoiding the decision can lead an individual to make a decision at the last minute or have the decision being made for them. Instead, confronting the decision head-on can allow for time to weigh the pros and the cons of each option and to potentially consider ways to make one of the options less bad. In the example above, the individual might contact their creditors to negotiate a repayment plan with lower monthly payments. So this can kind of just apply to life in general, Aaron, but absolutely, I think it really applies to our industry.
Definitely.
Because people tend to put off financial decisions that stress them out or because they don't want to think about it. And I absolutely think the first thing that comes to my mind is estate planning, right? No one wants to think about their own mortality. However, it is one of the most important things that you have to do.
Sure.
Even though you might not want to think about it. Same thing with, you know, naming beneficiaries on the account. While it might seem fine in the short run not to do those things, you know, any one of us can get hit by a bus tomorrow, right?
And the thing is, you're just creating a headache for the for your heirs or the next generation, right?
Right, exactly. So there's a lot of things when it comes to financial planning that require a lot of thought, time, and effort. But it is well worth it. And, you know, we can say that speaking from experience because we've dealt with several unfortunate situations where, you know, estate plans weren't in place or there were no wills or no power of attorneys. And it just makes the situation, which is emotionally very challenging, just even harder,
more challenging,
and drags out the process. So, you know, and I even do this sometimes when I put things off, I'm like, maybe this is going to take care of itself, right? But 99% of the time it doesn't. So
I'm the same way.
I will hand it off to you.
Perfect. First item I have is it's a tweet from Bespoke Investment Group. It's on April 16th, so just a couple days ago, and its tweet says, simply looking at top and bottom line results versus consensus expectations, 16 of 17 companies have reported have beaten EPS estimates, while 13 of 16 have beaten sales estimates. Not a bad start to earnings season. So,
yeah,
you know, a lot of early reporters, banks, things like that. But United Healthcare is in the mix, so off to a pretty good start. So I think that's, you know, that's encouraging for April. But you know, sometimes it's buy the rumor, sell the news. So we'll kind of see what happens here over the next several weeks of earnings season.
Right. And it's just, it's funny because this graphic that we're looking at, there's a whole lot of green, right?
Meaning absolutely.
You know, companies are beating earnings, they're beating sales estimates. But if you just looked at this and you had no idea what the market has been doing over the past 2 weeks,
oh yeah,
you'd probably assume the market was
doing
up,
great, right?
That's
a great point.
So that's just, again, that's the funny thing about markets is, and especially with earnings, a lot of people are like, hey, you know, JP Morgan's earnings looked great. Why did the stock fall from 190 to 170 almost? And again, we have to remember that a lot of this stuff has been priced into these stocks over the past several
six months, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So JP Morgan, for example, the past 6 months, it's been great.
Absolutely.
Right? But then we get to this earnings season and earnings were great. People expect that strength in the stock is going to continue, but they forget that the market is forward looking and
right,
some of this stuff at least has
already
been
baked in,
priced
right
in, yep, right? So don't be surprised if we see all of these earnings beats in
the
Q2
market still sells off.
And the market sells off because the market is taking in a lot more information than just company earnings.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. So they're taking in, you know, the forward guidance. I think that's the biggest thing right now is what does forward guidance look like?
They're taking in the Fed. They're taking in what's going on in the Middle East, other
absolutely
geopolitical events going on across the world. So it's a lot of information.
Absolutely.
So,
all right. I just thought that was kind of interesting, you know, getting into earnings season with the market. You're exactly right. If you looked at this, you'd think the market was a perfect straight line up.
Right.
Got another tweet for you. This is from Ben Carlson, one of my favorite blogs, posters, writers, tweeters, you might say. Mm-hmm. So this is, he says, understanding the post-pandemic economy in one chart. This is from April 15th, and it is U.S. retail sales. And it's, I mean, it's just a huge jump since the pandemic. It's really, really interesting to show, you know, kind of, I think there's still a decent amount of consumer confidence out there.
Yeah, there is. And it's kind of baffling that consumer spending hasn't really slowed down at all.
It hasn't.
Right. I mean, it made sense within like the first years after COVID, right? Because there was that stimulus money that was going around and people had a lot of money.
We're 3 years past now.
Yeah, we're 3 years removed it, and we've had pretty significant inflation. But people are still spending.
Yeah, I think they're in kind of a travel boom, a spending boom. So it's really interesting. There was this kind of tweet back and forth between Ben. I didn't include all of it in here, but basically saying, you know, credit card rates are ticking up significantly, which Ben puts another chart up of percent of balance 90 plus days delinquent by loan type. So one person argued that, you know, credit card rates are significantly higher. But I like the second chart that shows the balance of 90 days delinquent. And it's just, you know, credit cards have ticked up a little bit, but not into, you know, a range, you know, even close to 08 or 09. So it's getting higher, but it's really not in a, you know, a scary range.
Right.
Same thing with mortgages, auto loans, you know, pretty much every loans are nowhere near all time highs right now for delinquency rates, which I think is encouraging. I think it goes to show, you know, the American consumer is stronger than, you know, a lot of people think or give them credit
for.
Yeah,
I think so too. And, you know, I listen to Michael and Ben's podcast every week, and they were just talking about how, you know, from day to day, people are like, oh my God, things are so much more expensive. You know, personally, I'm not doing as well as I once was, but the economy keeps humming along. And it's like, sure, everyone's personal situations are going to have their own challenges.
Right.
But if you look at it just through general lenses, the economy's kind of just doing fine right now.
Yeah,
and I
absolutely
think this shows this. And I think a lot of it has to do with the strong employment that we've seen. I think a lot of people expected unemployment to tick up over the past half a year, and it really hasn't. So obviously when unemployment is low, spending is going to be good. And what drives 2/3 of the American economy, it's consumer spending.
Yep, which we need.
So until that turns around, I don't really see the economy going through another tough time until Americans stop spending, right?
Absolutely.
Interesting chart by Ben here. You know, I would have initially thought that, you know, spending would have, you know, come back online with trend pre-COVID.
Yeah, long-term trends.
But it's still clearly very elevated above
that. It is very elevated. It jumped up pretty quickly, and it's kind of floated around that level, not kind of at that parabolic level of spending anymore, but kind of flattening out. So we'll see, you know, as we get later into the year, if consumer confidence continues to hold up and if spending holds up. So we'll see.
Clearly people obviously don't like inflation.
No.
But they're contributing to it. Yeah, exactly. It hasn't gotten bad enough where people have said, well, I'm just not going
to
buy that.
Yeah, I'm not going to go out to eat. I'm not going to go travel.
Right.
People are still doing it.
Yeah.
Last thing I have for you is another tweet or X post by Carl Quintanilla. And he says, Morgan Stanley pushes first rate cut expectation to July from June and takes one cut from this year, but still expects three cuts of negative 25 basis points this year and four more in 2025, with the Fed funds target range ending the year at 4.5 to 4.75 and next year at 3.5 to 3.75. So I think that's interesting. You know, I tend to agree, but my personal opinion, I think rates could get pushed out even a little bit further than that, than July. What's your take on it?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting.
It's a guessing game.
It is a guessing game. And I think, you know, a lot of weight is given to Fed estimates on where rates are going to be. But the truth is, none of us really know, right?
No.
Coming into 2024, there was supposed to be like six rate cuts, with the first being in March of 2024.
Right.
And here we are in April, and we still don't have any rate cuts.
Yep.
And now people are starting to realize, okay, maybe the Fed isn't going to cut for, you know, a significant amount of time, which I think is fine. It's just I think these estimates do more harm than good, because are you as an investor really going to change your behavior depending on if the Fed cuts rates or not? And my argument would be no.
Most likely not. Not major long-term strategy. The only thing I could see is, you know, short-term rates going down. Maybe you're not as heavily in money markets or more conservative areas. But from the general, if you're in the market, you're probably still going to be in the market if rates are lower.
Right. Exactly. So, and we've seen over history that sometimes when the Fed cuts rates, the market does well. And sometimes when the Fed cuts rates, the market does poorly. And it seems like that's dependent on the speed and the velocity of how fast they're cutting rates. And, you know, looking back at history, the slower and more methodical the Fed is about cutting rates, the better that is for risk on assets. Yeah. But, you know, if the Fed cuts very quickly and steeply, like in 2000 and 2007 and 2008, the market tends to struggle.
Right. Yeah, I guess the kind of argument there is, you know, they're cutting so fast because the economy's falling off a cliff. Right. So we're not seeing that, which is obviously good. So I think, you know, maybe we do have continued slow, very slow stair step down.
Right.
Which would be good.
And I don't think this is a negative thing, right? If the Fed's just holding rates where they are, like we just talked about, the economy seems to be doing just fine right now.
Right.
So it's not necessarily a bad thing. And we saw in 2023, rates were the most elevated we've seen them in quite a long time. And stocks did great last year.
Absolutely.
So I think it's more things that I guess people in our industry should be concerned about. But for your average investor, do they really need to know what people think about the Fed? I don't think
The only thing I would say is, you know, if you're looking to refinance or something like that, be 100%. Patient, right?
That's 100%.
That's where I would think if you're
and
an average consumer.
I think that's where it really comes into play, right? I bet you there are millions of people out there waiting to refinance, right?
So they're wanting the Fed to cut sooner so their rates are lower, but also you want it to happen slowly for the economy's sake.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. And the market's sake, it's a double-edged sword, just like most things in finance, right?
All right.
Go ahead and let's move on to the financial planning topic of the week. I know that you picked an article to talk about today. So what do we got?
So found an article. Michael Kitsis retweeted this, and I clicked into the article from CNBC, and it's these behavioral traits lead to greater retirement savings, research finds. It says yet only 10% of workers have them all. So I just wanted to go through kind of the four traits they have down here and talk about it a little bit. So the first trait it says you want to have is over-optimism. So it says when it comes to retirement planning, workers may want to take a cue from Warren Buffett, who always has a positive outlook for the country and future results. The research found a general tendency of overestimating the probability of positive events coupled with overconfidence or having a perception that is better than reality can help improve retirement preparedness. The writer Cedar says, when you have that level of optimism, you're comfortable taking steps in order to achieve the goals that you have in the future. People who exhibit these traits have higher level of financial management, willingness to take risk and plan for emergencies, the research found. So I think that makes sense. You know, if you're thinking, you know, 20, 30 years down the line is going to be great, you probably want to be financially prepared to, you know, take advantage of that. So I think that's a good couple things to keep in mind.
Yeah, I think, you know, in other words, you know, sometimes it helps to be a little cocky, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Works for your favor. You know, I think, again, too many people spend time preparing for bad times in the economy and in the stock market where, in reality, 3 out of every 4 years are usually up for stock. So we should be spending most of our time figuring out how we're going to allocate our money to help us get to where we want to be when we're 50 or 60 or 70, whenever that age is that we retire. So.
And what I see in planning, a lot of people that are like, they're kind of historically negative. Oh, I'm never going to be able to retire.
Yeah,
right?
That's exactly
they don't
right.
ever spend any time on it because they're like, oh, I don't have enough money to save to retire anyway. So just keep working. But, you know, the people that are willing to, they're excited for retirement or confident that they can do it, they stick to it way better.
Yeah.
So,
and I think it's really easy to show them that mindset can be flipped because all you have to do is show a hypothetical growth calculation of, you know, contributing X amount of dollars into your 401k with your company match in 20 years. This is what you can have.
Right.
But you have to start by contributing 3, 4, 5, 6% to make that happen, right?
Absolutely. Second trait is future orientation. So kind of what we were just talking about, right? So says how well people connect with their future selves also impacts retirement preparedness. Those who have this trait are more likely to have smart spending, saving, money management skills, the research found. In order to save for something, you have to understand where you're going. So
yeah,
it's important to have goals, right?
It is. And, you know, I think I ask the question a lot of times to clients or to just to prospects. It's like, hey, how much do you think you need to be able to live the way you want to live in retirement? Right. And the most common answer is, I don't really know.
Yeah.
which is fine, right? But just because you don't know doesn't mean you can't be saving as much as you can without sacrificing, you know, other discretionary living expenses that make you happy right now. I would say the majority of people don't know how much money in retirement is enough, right?
And you know what? When I always get the I don't know, I always ask, well, what do you want to do in retirement,
right?
Do you want to travel? Do you want to keep, you know, your same standard of living, keep the same house? So, and then we can usually kind of reverse engineer, oh, you probably need about the same amount you have right now.
Right? Exactly. So. Then it's like, okay, well, let's take a look. How much money per month are you going to get from Social Security and your pension and your 401k, you know, and how much money more do we need to send you per month to, to live you the way you want to live, with at the same time having an understanding that we need to be able to send you a safe amount so that we can gap you from 60 to 95.
Right. Absolutely. Right? Yep.
So it's a really hard question to answer,
right?
But
and there's some unknowns in there. What's inflation going to be? We don't know. Right.
Right.
But that's why you save and invest, is to try to beat inflation.
100%. Yep. Protect that purchasing power.
Absolutely. Last couple here. So third trait is financial literacy. I think that kind of goes without saying, you know, just having knowledge on finances in general is very helpful. So, it says having financial know-how such as compound interest and diversification works, can help workers better reach their retirement goals. The good news is people can acquire this knowledge. Financial literacy is something that kind of grows over time, Cedar, the writer, says. However, the earlier you have this knowledge, the better the financial decisions you will make, which will help you get ahead when it comes to retirement preparedness, right?
Yeah, and it's so easy these days with like YouTube, right? You can
Absolutely.
Just go on, and there's a lot of great free content on YouTube. I wish this was something that was taught more in schools growing up.
I was just talking about a teacher that's a client that I met with, and she actually teaches kind of like financial literacy, which I thought was fantastic.
That's
for
awesome.
The school district. And this district is making it mandatory going forward for everyone to take it, which I think is amazing.
It's awesome. It's great. It's just, you know, I was joking with Kelly in our office the other day. We were talking to somebody about how it's kind of baffling how they never teach you how to do your taxes in school or budgeting or anything
That's
like that.
'Cause a lot of that stuff's hard.
Right. Exactly. But, and then she sent me like a meme, and it said something along the lines of, I know what this, you know, volcanic rock is from third grade or whatever, but I still don't know how to do a budget or do my taxes.
Yeah,
and it's kind of true.
Yeah. You know, geology, but you can't explain a progressive tax system.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Exactly. So it's just one of those things that unfortunately you kind of have to take on that responsibility yourself, but it's especially today with YouTube and the internet, it's pretty easy to do.
Absolutely. Last one, trait is risk versus reward. I think you were kind of hinting at this. So, retirement savers may fall into one of two camps: those who pursue goals with a focus on achievement, or those who instead focus on security and protection. Those in the first group are more likely to take proactive steps with financial preparation, including having a personalized financial plan and reviewing retirement savings. They are also more willing to lean into risks, having the opportunity. The opposite mentality of risk avoidance is not nearly as effective for reaching those retirement goals. So I think that's huge. You know, if you're constantly concerned about the market, even, you know, in your 20s and 30s and 40s, and you never get into it, you're going to miss out on a lot of return potentially over a long period of time. So that's one of the biggest things I see a lot of people make huge mistakes on, is being too conservative for too long.
Yeah. And it just makes you forced to save more,
three times as much
out of all of your pay, if you're not aggressive earlier in your life.
Absolutely.
And hey, I get it. I understand that, you know, stocks and investing isn't for everyone, but we at least have to keep up with inflation, because the dollar today is not going to be worth what the dollar is in a year from now. And, you know, that's fine if you want to be more conservative. You just have to be okay with potentially not living the life you want to live in retirement.
Right.
Right. Right. There's trade-offs. You can't have your cake and eat it too.
For sure. So the end of the article just basically says what investors can do. So as aspiring retirees juggle competing life priorities, much of what it takes to be successful comes down to balancing today's lifestyle and future goals. People who are disciplined with their money, disciplined with their life, really are going to go so much further. John Merrill, president and founder of Tanglewood Total Wealth Management in Houston, recently told CNBC, mental health also affects workers' ability to plan adequately for retirement, research has found. So to better prepare for retirement, workers should remind themselves that the future may be equally as interesting and bright. I think that's a great point, you know, thinking that retirement's going to be awesome, you want to get to it, right, and enjoy it. So, you know, it says, while developing all four traits identified in research is important, two traits, optimism and future orientation, should be the priority. I tend to agree with that. So,
yeah, I agree too. I think it was a really good article. And, you know, just like anything else in life, you have to plan for retirement. But again, in order to achieve the reward of having this sum of money that you're going to be able to spend in retirement, you have to put in that work during your working years to get to that point, right? It's not just
take some sacrifice.
And guess what? The stock market doesn't owe any of us anything, right? And the one thing that I'll leave with people is the sequence of return risk is a real thing, right? So just because you are retiring next year doesn't mean the stock market knows that, right? The stock market is going to do what the stock market's going to do. And even though the market is up 3 out of every 4 years on average, the year you retire might be a year the market's down 30%, right? Sure. So that's why we're talking so much about putting in the work before you get to that 5 years away from retirement age, so that you can still withstand that and be okay in retirement and allow time for the market to recover and the accounts to recover.
And, you know, a retiree is probably not going to be at their most aggressive range at that point too. So, you know, how I always like to kind of frame, you know, that scenario is, you know, you have some conservative investments in your mix with, you know, more risk on assets, right? Mm-hmm. So if you do have a slower year right when you retire, well, you have your bucket of money that you can pull from and live off of and give this other side of money time to recover.
Right, exactly. I think that's a great way to think about it. And some people even, like, you know, when they retire, they're like, hey, I want to take a year's worth of income or 2 years worth of income, especially when the market's down, and be like, hey, that's a great idea. You know, you're covered for the next 2 years. And
don't have to stress so much about this other bucket.
Correct.
Right?
And let that recover.
Absolutely.
So, well, thanks everybody for tuning in to episode 248 of the Independent Advisors Podcast. Aaron, thanks for joining me today. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Happy to be back on.
And I'm sure we will see you at some point later this year.
Sounds good.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for listening to the Independent Advisors Podcast. If you're interested in hearing more, hit the subscribe button so you can be notified every time a new episode gets released. Feel free to share with friends, family, and follow us on Twitter at Jessup Wealth, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Mark and Matt will continue to share beneficial information on these social media sites. Also, check out the podcast tab on their website. That's www.jessupwealthmanagement.com. There you'll find links to every episode of the Independent Advisors. Have questions or topics you want to discuss on the show? Message us on Twitter, LinkedIn, or send an email with the words questions and topics in the subject line to inquiries@jessupwealthmanagement.com. We'll talk about it right here on the podcast. Certain sections of this commentary may contain forward-looking statements based on reasonable expectations, estimates, projections, and assumptions. Forward-looking statements are not guarantees of future performance and involve certain risks and uncertainties, which are difficult to predict. All indices are unmanaged and are not available for direct investment by the public. Past performance is not indicative of future results. This podcast is provided for general informational purposes only and does not constitute either tax, legal, or financial advice. Although we do go to great lengths to make sure our information is accurate and useful, we recommend you consult a tax preparer, professional tax advisor, financial advisor, or lawyer regarding your specific circumstances. Investing involves risk, including the loss of principal. No strategy can guarantee any objective or goal will be achieved.